I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Richard Rossiter. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you very much.
Richard, I'm just going to tell our listeners a little bit about you, mm-hmm. because this is very impressive, Richard. You live in Perth, Western Australia, that is to say you're a West Australian, and an honorary associate professor at Edith Cowan University. And you've taught literary studies, supervised postgraduate creative writing students, and judged numerous writing awards, including the WA Premier's Book Awards. And you've published a range of critical and biographical works focused on WA writing. I won't go through all of your writing, we can talk about that a bit later. But relevantly for today, you're also one of the, five judges for the Hungerford Award, the next one coming up in 2026. Tell me, how many have you judged?
Well, that is a good question. I've been told that I've been doing it for the last 12 competitions, which is 24 years, and I find that a bit of a stretch, but I accept that that's probably true. So well, that's how long I've been doing it.
You must have started when you were about 14 or something, Richard, in that case.
Of course, yes, it was. I did start young, you're quite right.
It's always interesting to me, judging. People forget about the judges. On the Hungerford night, the shortlist, the people are all up on the stage, someone's eventually announced, there's mention of the judges, but it's as though it's just automatic. How did you get the gig?
How did I get into it?
Yes.
I had trouble remembering that too. I'm pretty sure Dallas Bird was the person who chaired the judging panel for quite a long time. And I'm almost certain that Dallas would have perhaps even casually said, "Would you like to join the judging panel?" And I think it was something of that order. And I said, yes, it would be a pleasure. And I think that's probably how it started.
Well, I think it would have been, but had you thought about, if you can remember back 12 judgings ago, what judges do? Did you have some sense? Was it at all intimidating?
I suppose because of being involved in various editorial roles and way back even in high school level very briefly, but, you know, looking at submissions of writing for magazines and so on, it wasn't entirely foreign territory, you know. So well, I had some idea, for sure.
Now, am I right in saying there's five of you that get to judge this? Or is it three of you plus...?
It's three. That's also... everything about it, this is a little bit sort of tricky, I suppose. There are three judges who take on the bulk of the work. And when I say the bulk of the work, there's roughly about 80 entries come in for it, they're full-length works, and the three judges get into that and they do the reading of those entries. They come to a long list that gets paired back to a short list, and that's what usually goes to the Fremantle Press, to Georgia Richter and whoever else is involved.
I think there. Kate Sutherland this year.
Okay.
So Chemitai Lachine, who I've interviewed on the Shipping News, Marcella Pallain, yourself, you're the judges, but alongside Fremantle Press publisher Georgia Richter and Kate Sutherland, you're together responsible for choosing who's going to win $15,000 prize money from the City of Fremantle, a publishing contract with Fremantle Press, and a Centre for Stories Fellowship. It's a pretty good award.
Oh, it's a terrific award. And when you look over the years of the people who have won it and think that this was the start of their writing careers, it really has set people up.
Well, I remember Holden Shepherd was the first Hungerford Award winner that I interviewed, and he's certainly gone on to greater things. He even had his own television show.
Right, okay. I didn't know that.
So
well, yeah, there
that,
you go.
That is to say they took his book and turned it into a streaming.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about your background. Were you always wanting to be involved in writing, creative writing, and academic side of it?
Yeah. I mean, the early days. I started off teaching at ECU a long time ago, and then. As that institution started to develop from a teacher's college, actually, into a university, and then started to take on the traditional sorts of areas, I guess, in terms of of postgraduate study, but a very strong push in terms of writing occurred there. And so a lot of the work that I did in the last 10, 15 years there was supervising creative writing students. And that was a real pleasure because there were some really outstanding students there that came through and they've published and they've gone on to sorts of careers and so on. So that was strong. I always dabbled a bit myself, a little, had certain sort of, not driven by it, but certainly an interest in it. So at a certain point I decided I'd stop the teaching and supervising and I would focus more on what I saw as another part of what I wanted to do with my life. And so I moved into my own creative writing work, so some short fiction and longer works and so on. So it's not been a massive output or anything like that, but it was very satisfying to see the works out there and published by UWA Press at the time. So
we'll come back to a question I want to ask you about whether there's something distinctive in WA writing. But first, you mentioned earlier you're expecting about 80 manuscripts to come in. And what's the process? We know they have to all lodge by a certain date. And then they come, to the three judges that we've mentioned. And you start looking at them. Do you divvy them up? How does it happen?
Ask me that again.
Yeah. When the manuscripts come how do you deal with them? Do you share them out between the three of you?
Oh, I see. Yeah, there was... Originally, when they were hard copy, there was some sort of debate about that. Yes, I know.
Oh, of course, they're not just hard copy.
Yeah, so they had to be sort of shuffled around to the judges, and Fremantle Press would sort of pick them up from one judge and take them along to another judge. Chaos. Not really. It worked. But now, of course, they're all online, and we all read all of them. There isn't a sort of an attempt to divvy them up, and so then you just have to read a third of them. That seems to me far too fraught, really, to do it that way, because there's often, sometimes it's just one judge picks something out and says, hey, this is terrific, we really love it, da-da-da-da-da, and that then will force the other judges who perhaps haven't selected it to have another look. And that second look has often paid off a lot. It's resulted in works ending up on shortlists and awarded, So
it's that's why we have more than one judge.
That's why you have more than one judge, absolutely.
And I mean, is it hard just sitting pouring through 80 or whatever number come in this year? I mean, how long does it take you to read a manuscript?
Yeah, well, I don't know whether I'm odd about this. I'm sort of fixated on print, I think, but I do read all of 90% or 95% of the entries. In other words, even if an entry you start after a while, you get a bit of a feel for the field, and you have some idea of this work's really good. You sort of have a sense starting to put works into heaps in a way, highly very good, pretty good, not so good. That type of thing. And then when you start to move along the pathway with that in mind, you can tell at a certain point, sometime pretty early on, this is not going to get into the really good pile. But for some reason, I feel obsessed enough to want to finish the work. So I tend to read all of them all the time. I think some other judges might be a little bit more efficient and don't do that, but I'm not sure about that.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, are we talking about reading 80-odd manuscripts over, a couple of months?
Yeah, have a few months, thank goodness. So it is very busy, but I'm quite fascinated by it because of and I've said this a few times in the past, that the range of works you get in is stunning, really, in terms of the differences. Well, I actually made
tell us about that, because I mean that would be the excitement. You don't know what the next thing is that you are notionally picking up is going to appear on your computer screen.
I actually made a bit of a note about last time around about the ones that came in and the ones that were shortlisted.
The Trails of Hope, a powerful autobiographical account of a boy shepherd growing up in Ethiopia, and it's a mix of poetry and prose. I Remember Everything is an utterly convincing account of the arrival of the AIDS epidemic in Paris. It reads like autobiography. Judges, at least two of the three judges, were convinced it was. One other judge had a bit of inside knowledge and knew it wasn't. It's fiction. It's amazing. And then Screech is a YA novel focused on 10-year-old Bonnie and her pet cockatoo. Very, very moving and amusing. A far from wonderful, wonderfully engaging account of 24 hours in the life of a med student spanning her 21st birthday and her brother's funeral. Well, what a range, you know, truly. And yet it's indicative, really, of the wider range of entries that you get in. They are spread all over the place. They're fascinating little corners that are opened up in these works. And I always feel that it's indicative of, without, you know, any decent detailed research about the population of WA, but it seems to me that it is a pointer to the very rich, unusual mix of people who live in this part of the world, work in this part of the world, and contribute to it in these ways.
Well, you've got to the question that I mentioned earlier that I wanted to ask. Is there something distinctive that comes through all of this as WA literature?
Yeah, that's very tricky. I'm not sure. I mean, one of the sort of conventional ideas about writing in Australia generally, but perhaps more particularly in WA, is a strong sense of the geographical space. So the settings of them, the surroundings of them, that sort of presence of country is there in so many of the works. I haven't done any sort of detailed, you know, comparative study across the country to be sure to what extent it is distinctively Western Australian, but it does often feel like that to me, that people... I'll jump here to say too that, again, I haven't done a count, but the majority of works are not set in the city. So although the majority of the people live in the city, work in the city and so on, it seems that people's sense of what's important is what's outside of the city, that so-called country.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? It might encourage too many city dwellers who don't get out of the city to get out of the city.
Yes.
That's what, I guess, good literature does. It opens your eyes, it opens your imagination. What are you looking for? Do you go into starting to read, looking for something in the manuscripts?
No, I don't do that in any formal or structured sense. Occasionally, I think there have been judges who have a bit of a checklist, and they seem to be able to work that way quite effectively. I don't have anything that can easily name. So I knew you were going to ask that question, because you told me. But I did grab... I don't know whether this is appropriate at the moment. Tell me to shut up if this is going to just be a nuisance.
No, you've got the floor.
Two of the three writers who were in the first three winners are Gail Jones here and Simone Lazarou. I grabbed their books off my shelves a little before I came here, and I just looked at the first paras of them. I'll just give you an indication of... This is Simone's Between Water and the Night Sky. My mother's hand is still warm in mine. In the silence after she turns to face the darkness and exhales one last time, her eyes stay open but do not blink. I'm surprised by the low howl of some lost creature rising from me. Past, present and future collapse. Tenses collide. She was my mother. She is my mother. She will always be my mother. My only mother. The nurse hurries in. She must have heard my cry. So something like that really certainly hooks me in, and it's the voice in the writing as probably the easiest or best way to describe it. It's that presence of a narrating voice and the extent to which you get engaged by it. So although I don't have voice written down on a bit of paper, it's certainly what attracts any reader, I think. You can't, you get drawn to it, you start to hear it as much as anything, and there seems to be, in the case of this work of Simone's, there's an intimacy about it, there's a closeness. You sort of feel like my mother's hand is still warm in mine. You almost could be the my, you know.
You just have to go on, don't you? There was or is or used to be an old saying, you know, for creative writing, that prime real estate is in the first few sentences and paragraph.
Yeah, well, that's true. So the beginnings of works are incredibly important, but clearly it has to be sustained. And there are times with works that I've found that you start reading and you sort of think, and then it'll change gear. it'll turn out to be far better than you thought it could be, and that's very rewarding to keep going. It's rare that they turn out to be worse. So there's often a patchiness about it. And I'm also quite surprised at the extent to which all these entries, all these people with a lot of different backgrounds, different experience, different everything, very often, they manage to pull it off. You know, they manage to get a work that's really largely very good. And there's often just bits of it that aren't very good, but it's enough to push them out of the final list of stuff. So you sort of feel like you should be able to get hold of these people and say, hey, listen, that was really very good stuff. Don't give up. Keep going. You know?
Well, I'd be very pleased to hear that. You've got Gail James's.
Yeah, well, I got Gail's simply partly because, as I said, these two were the two of the three who won the very first 3 years of the award. So Gail's novel, This Is the Name of the Sister, this is her latest work. Mostly he stared ahead or hid his face with his hands, oblivious. Here was a white-haired man sitting beside a crumpled house, blankly reporting that his wife and children were entombed. His head was low, his posture was huddled. Deprived of biography and interior, viewers saw only a pitiable surface, eyes pouched with weeping, skin ashen with knowledge of death, the faintest tremble of his hand raised in a shield to say, go away. So...
Well, I'm trembling at this moment.
So it sets up a different feel, obviously, than Simone's. It's a little more distant in the sense that it holds you out and makes you think about it a little more. So they're two quite different works, but I think that they both have got that ability to have a voice in there that engages the reader almost immediately. So
I have some friends with, I'm not sure that I agree with them, but rigid rules about reading a novel. And I've forgotten exactly how it works. It'll be something like, if they haven't got my attention by the seventh page, I'm not going on.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there are works that are more... I mean, Gail's in that category, I think, of that sort of sometimes fairly intellectual writing, if you like. But I think there are works that are really to do more with ideas, concepts... That explore things at that level. And that's a different sort of a work, a different sort of engagement and so on. I mean, I'm happy to read crime fiction. I like a strong plot. I like characters who, you know, get out there and do stuff.
I asked Jane Harper in relation to crime fiction whether it's true that at exactly halfway through, if there's 300 pages in the book, that at 150 there's a significant plot development. And she said, there is. That's true. But you've raised an interesting question, which I did want to ask you about that, and that's about the range of manuscripts that come through, the topics, that more intellectual approach, something that's feeling perhaps sort of Ian McEwan-ish, that, you know, it's a psychological play with you, and then there's others that are more, I don't know, just descriptive, telling a story.
Mm.
Do you get the range?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I was sort of, in a way, by looking back at those four
those
from
two.
Last time,
yes.
That they are very much part of that range. Someone who worked, who did a while ago, just got to remind myself, yeah, Robert Edison's The Weaver Fish. I remember when I, in reading that, and that struck me as a work that sort of is distinctively different, if you like, because it does play a lot with ideas and concepts, but at the same time it's quite strongly driven by, I suppose you'd call it, plot. So that has that sort of mix. I don't know if I have a clear preference, especially when it comes to judging, about any particular form or not. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed reading Screech from last time. I thought that was an amazing story. You know, the parrot was a major character, and I'm not sure that I very often am engaged with a parrot or a cockatoo, actually. I'm not sure what the difference is. So, you know, and that was YA fiction, so you're reading at a different level in many ways, but it's just thoroughly pleasurable.
We should remind our listeners that the manuscripts arrive digitally, as we've been reminded. You've got them on the screen, but you don't know who's written them. You don't know whether it's a man or a woman, or, you know, whether they're native-born Western Australian, whether they've migrated from Sydney or North Queensland or come from Africa or China or somewhere.
Yeah.
But I suppose as you get into some of these, the subject matter is such that you think, oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
This must be written by a woman. But you were then giving the case of the fictional or not fictional issue in Paris, and you can be wrong about it all.
Yes, who has the right to speak for parrots? One can imagine there might be a debate about that.
Does the anonymity, is that something easy to work with? You just read it, like listening to the violinist beyond the curtain. You don't know whether they're an 80-year-old man or a 22-year-old woman.
Yeah, I mean, because it's Perth, Western Australia.
Yes.
There's
a certain number that it
has to be. There's a limit in terms of, and the judges from quite rather different backgrounds and so on, so on, so on. So it's going to happen from time to time that someone will pick up an entry and say, I bet I know who wrote this. And there have been cases when that's happened where people have decided to excuse themselves from it, or say, I feel quite secure about this, I do know who wrote it, or I'm pretty sure I know who wrote it, but I feel that I can stand back enough, and so on, so on, so on.
Well, it'd be terrible if you were wrong, which leads me to another question. We won't get deeply into AI, but from what I'm told, I could go to AI and say, I want to submit an unpublished manuscript for the Hungerford Award in Western Australia. I meet the qualifications, I'm under the age. But I think it's time to come up with something that's not Picasso in its illumination, but it's got a bit of Tim Winton there, and I want it to be about this. I mean, do you run into things and you think this person is shadowing Tim or whomever it might be, Randolph Stowe? Does that sort of thing happen?
Do you mean literally about AI, or are you saying just more figuratively?
More figuratively, that if you see that someone's been influenced. If they're a cricketer, they're playing a cover drive like Kim Hughes, not their own.
Yeah, I think there are times when you do feel that there is evidence of influence, but in a way, you know, it's almost impossible to remove all levels of influence. If people have read widely, and a lot of the writers do read widely, They've been brought up in a formal way, a number of them at least, in terms of their educational backgrounds and so on and so on. But what you do raise, I think, the question of AI, I mean, I think that's just starting. And I think it's going to be diabolically difficult as it gets more sophisticated, because some of that stuff, I've played around with it a little bit. One of my kids is pretty whiz-bang with this stuff, and we've tried it out a little bit, just we're saying, say, okay, here are the ingredients, write me a story that's got da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And really, that's, even now, it's not too bad. It's and I can imagine that it will get to a point where it's actually very good. And I don't know how you deal with that.
Well, universities already, and I think creative writing courses from what I hear, say to the students, if you use AI, you fail and you're out of here.
Yeah, but sort of what I've read about some of that, at least, the universities have had trouble proving that.
Yes.
And the tests that they've done, some of the AI investigations that have come up and said, hey, this has been, you have used AI, here, and people have challenged it. And they've won. So, you know, your background, you would know more about the ins and outs of this than anyone, probably.
Well, it's a growing area, but the hope of it is covered like all of these awards, because it has to be an original work. So if you turn up with something that's AI, the question is whether people are attesting, in a sense, for plagiarism.
Well, I mean, it's your sort of mix of AI or your sort of dealing with it that hasn't been done before. So it is original.
It is original.
But how are we going to award the AI body the award? Them the publisher's fees? I don't know. It's tricky.
It is. Well, I hasten to add, just for a note for our listeners, that there's nothing in anything that's happened with the Hungerford Award which actually raises the question. I'm just fascinated by it because I'm fascinated by AI and where it's taking us. And the points you make, Richard, are really interesting. Have the judges ever tried to issue a set of tips or guidelines or things that submitters might take into account?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I mean, the guidelines are sort of only those very broad things about length, which they've cut back a bit, I noticed this time, about... I mean, this is not what you asked, I know, but say for short fiction, for example, is not available. It can't be submitted this time around. But the verse novel, as we mentioned briefly,
novels can't. Now tell me, tell our listeners what a verse novel is. And are there many of them being written?
You're asking the wrong person. I've dipped very lightly into verse novels. It's new territory. I mean, obviously, it's verse, and it has a sort of narrative underpinning of some sort that makes it, I guess, a novel, unless it's some very, very experimental, fragmented approach, which is sort of an impressionistic, so it doesn't even have a strong sense of narrative. I think almost anything that's in verse form could be counted as a verse novel, but you're not talking to someone who knows much about this at all. So there.
Fremantle Shipping News regularly publishes the Wednesday poem, and you get a variety of ways of writing poetry these days, which probably lend itself to this. I'm also thinking whether Salman Rushdie's, I'll say it quietly, Satanic Verses had a verse novel aspect to it. I don't recall that it did, but I do like the idea of it. It's the idea that you read something which is, in a sense, telling the story, narrative.
Yes.
It also has this extra, I don't know.
Well, I think the reason why the press have to really talk to Georgia about this, but why they've introduced that is that there is a sort of a sense that as a genre is something that's increasingly popular, people wanting to go down those paths, to explore that route. So it's entirely appropriate to have it available, I think, and to see what happens, see what it opens up.
Going back to the mechanics of the process, the simple, you know, nuts and bolts of having to come up with lists which are going to produce a winner.
Yeah.
I don't know whether there's ever been a co-winner, I suspect not. But you go through, you work out what you like.
Yeah.
You make notes, you, in a sense, make sort of proverbial piles. This one's in that doesn't make the grade. These are the ones I'm working from. Is there a point at which, when you still got things fairly fluid in your mind, that the judges meet and throw things around?
Yeah. So typically what's happened in the last whatever years is that judges will read quite independently for a start. They all have copies of the entire submissions. We try to come up with a long list of maybe more, about 15 to absolute number, 20 max, and then meet and say, we've got to get this down to about 8 to 10 entries. They will be passed on to Georgia and Company to make those final decisions. And that's pretty interesting time. I mean, there's you know, clearly there's times when certain entries everyone thinks are great, so that's easy. They can stay on the list. And then there's others where one person might have it, you know, as in their top 4 or 5, and someone else has got it down number 19 and that sort of stuff. So there's quite a lot of interactions going on there. And then at times there's people say, okay, well, I've got to go back. I missed that. I'll go back and reread that one, and so on. There's also been a bit of a convention to say, look, if there's a title in there that you just are dying to see on the list, you know, you just think it's fabulous. The rest of us might think, but okay, you have the right to add it to the list.
I'm really pleased
and
to
that's,
hear that.
And that happens.
This is Henry Fonda in 12 Good Men. So somebody hangs out there in the jury, they just insist. Not very easily overwritten.
Okay.
But you're invited to say, look, I just love Britta's work and I want to make, well, I don't know it's Britta, but geez, it sounds like hers. I want to see it here. I want to debate it with you.
Yeah.
Is that what then happens? You try to convince them?
It should happen like that in a way, you would think. But actually what tends to happen, I don't know whether people just get sick of it. I don't think so. But if that happens, then people tend to go back and say, yeah, well, I've had another look at it. I agree, you know, I might not have it in the absolute top, but I didn't pick up well enough. And I think that can happen, especially if people are reading fairly quickly, say, and they perhaps don't read the full work or whatever happens. So that's a bit of a safety thing. And in one case, fairly recently, in the last 2 years, there was an entry that one judge picked up and had it there and so on, said, yeah, I think this is really good. And that ended up, you know, on a short list, and it ended up getting published. So that was a case just of one person saying, and other judges are, yes. So, you know, you think, okay, good.
Well, that's the beauty of the system, isn't it? And strong minds, people have read this before. Your 12th time. Mm. Tell me, what have you sort of learned as a judge, and what have you gained, if you like, by way, I don't know, of trends or quality of writing or topics in whether it's the 24 years or something less?
I should be able to answer that in some way, but I find that really difficult. I don't, when books are published at the end, you know, some of the shortlist, the winner and some of the shortlist and that, I tend not to reread them for a start. So I might have read them a couple of years ago, and I might have read them a couple of times then in draft. But and I should be better at this, but I don't tend to reread them when they're in published form. So I guess a lot of them don't stay with me very strongly. So I'm not really aware of those sorts of shifts much, apart from what I said earlier about the sheer range of material that comes in and the quality of it. The consistent quality of it, the wide range, the sort of dedication, if you like, of the writers to their task, I find that really impressive.
That's the thing I'm getting from this. You couldn't keep doing it as you do and the others coming on board unless you really knew you were going to have fun, in a sense.
Yeah.
Seeing what people are writing, their dedication, as you just put it, and your own dedication. You're seeing writers come through.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, you do. You know, there are names, you know, when I was looking at this list, you know, Brenda Walker, Gail Jones, Simone Lazarou, they're the first three names on the list. They're all well-known writers in WA or Australia or the world in some cases.
Yes.
So, you know, it's life-changing. It absolutely life-changing for them, I think. So, you know, it's a terrific competition. People should enter it.
and I know they will. I mean, mentioning those writers, I mean, do you have a couple of real favourites amongst the winners over the years? Whether or not you read them when they were published.
One work that did has stayed with me. I mean, I suppose it's, I don't know who you talk about favourites or how you would...
You have to be careful here. Mention me, Richard.
But in one book that struck me at the time that I liked and when it came out was Jerry McCann's work. I'm just trying to grab the title.
Anatomy.
Yeah.
It's a powerful book, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a powerful book. And that went on to win the Premier's Book Award for Non-Fiction as well.
Yes.
So that did extremely well. And because I did read that again afterwards, maybe that's why it stuck with me.
Yes.
But I did think it was very well written and very strong and so on. So, yeah. But whether there are big shifts in terms of what people are doing, I don't know. A decent sort of analysis of it all would tell you that. But because of this program in part, I sort of started to think, well, okay, so if you have been doing it for all those times, you know, you've read, I don't know, 80 books by... You've read...
By 24.
600, 700, 800 submissions or some astonishing number. So it's hard to, you know...
Well, like being a person in the record industry, you have to play all of these wannabe pop singers and listen to them in the car. But are you a prolific reader? You've always got a book going?
Yeah, I do always have a book.
And what are you reading at the moment? Generally, are you into crime fiction and can't put it down?
I read on a Kindle because I've decided I cannot fit any more books into my house. It's just ridiculous. There's thousands of them, literally. Mm. So I try not buy hard copy books, which is really bad to say this for the writers.
Well, I think it's very practical. I do the same.
Do you?
Yeah. If you're getting on a plane, you're going somewhere, you can't carry 10 books with you.
Yeah. But the problem with a Kindle is, for me, with my shocking memory, is that I... you don't have in front of you the title of the book.
No.
Or the author.
I'm with you there. This might be an age-related thing,
Richard. It probably is.
But I'm reading a book, and someone says, what are you reading? Oh, I'm reading a great book. It's by this German author. And oh, my God, I didn't realise it. You know, it's Thomas Mann all over again.
Yeah.
What's the title of the book? And I don't know. I can't remember. Because you open it, and you don't see the name each time you pick it up.
Exactly.
It should be a law against it, Richard.
Yeah. I was just trying to dig out while you spoke. I'm not sure what I'm reading. But I've written three books down here. One from the Booker list, Susan Choi, Flashlight. Heather Rose from Tassie's got a new book out, A Great Act of Love. Jane Harper's got a new book out. So they're the three that are on my list. They're very different works.
Different works. I'll make a note of them and go and read them, especially Jane Harper, to see whether she sticks to the halfway through the book significant plot development rule.
Yes. You can contact her if she doesn't.
If she's a page out. Now tell me, as we bring this to a close, all of those years, I'm guessing you've been really thrilled to do it. And trying to sum that up, what is it about judging the Hungerford Award that has kept you at it and
excuse me,
kept you young doing it?
I think it's just that sort of sense, as I was saying before, really, that you put in contact with a sense of a world out there that you can only glimpse the surface of again and again. But with the detail, the complexity, the power of a novel, that's an experience. You're not looking at it as something just as an onlooker, really. You become a participant, at least for the time of the work, And it's a pretty rich experience. That's the point. The range of material, the range of ideas, the range of characters, the range of passions that people have. And you think, this is a pretty interesting society that we live in. Even if on the surface it can look a bit bland. I don't know if it does. Maybe it does. But the reality of it is that there's this really rich mix. And it just feels fortunate to me to live in that part of the world and to even, however indirectly, to experience a lot of that as well through people's writing. So, you know, that's what I find. Like, I don't feel it's a lot of reading and a lot of work, but I don't feel like it's a burden. I quite look forward to it. So there you go.
Richard Rosevelt, thank you very much for joining me today to talk about Judging the Hunger.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Mark.